his shoulder in spite of the pillow. He went into the kitchen with his shirt still off and fixed a pot of coffee and a TV dinner. When he finished his meal, he went into the living room and laid down on the couch and began to cry. And the crying rose to a jagged, breaking hysteria, which he heard and feared, but could not control. At last it began to trail off, and he fell heavily asleep, breathing harshly. In his sleep he looked old, and some of the stubble on his cheeks was white. January 20, 1974. He woke with a guilty start, afraid it was morning and too late. His sleep had been as sodden and dark as old coffee, the kind of sleep he always woke from feeling stupid and cotton-headed. He looked at his watch and saw it was 2:15. The rifle was where he had left it, leaning nonchalantly in the easy chair. The magnum was on the end table. He got up, went into the kitchen, and splashed cold water on his face. He went upstairs and put on a fresh shirt. He went back downstairs, tucking it in. He locked all the downstairs doors, and for reasons he did not wish to examine too closely, his heart felt a tiny bit lighter as each tumbler clicked. He began to feel like himself again for the first time since that damnable woman had collapsed in front of him in the supermarket. He put the Weatherby on the floor by the living room picture window and stacked the shelves beside it, opening each box as he set it down. He dragged the easy chair over and set it on its side. He went into the kitchen and locked the windows. He took one of the dining room chairs and propped it under the kitchen doorknob. He poured himself a cup of cold coffee, sipped it absently, grimaced and dashed it into the sink. He made himself a drink. He went back into the living room and brought out the automobile storage battery. He put it behind the overturned easy chair, then got the jumper cables and coiled them beside the battery. He carried the case of explosive upstairs, grunting and puffing. When he got to the landing, he set it down with a thump and blew out his breath. He was getting too old for this sort of bullshit, even though a lot of the laundry muscle from the days when he and his partner had lifted 400-pound lots of iron sheets onto the delivery trucks was still there. But muscle or no muscle, when a man got to be 40, some things were tempting fate. By 40, it was attack time. He went from room to room upstairs, turning on all the lights, the guest bedroom, the guest bathroom, master bedroom, the study that had once been Charlie's room. He put a chair under the attic trap door and went up there, turning on the dusty bulb. Then he went down to the kitchen and got a roll of electrician's tape, a pair of scissors, and a sharp steak knife. He took 2 sticks of explosive from the crate, it was soft, and if you pressed it, you left fingerprints, and took them up to the attic. He cut 2 lengths of fuse and peeled the white insulation back from the copper core with the steak knife. Then he pressed each bare wire into one of the candles. In the closet, standing below the trap door now, he peeled the insulation from the other ends of the fuses and carefully attached 2 more sticks, taping the fuse firmly to each, so that the peeled wire wouldn't pull free. Humming now, he strung more fuse from the attic into the master bedroom and left a stick on each of the twin beds. He strung more fuse from there down the hall and left a stick in the guest bathroom, 2 more in the guest bedroom. He turned off the lights as he left. In Charlie's old room, he left 4 sticks, taped together in a cluster. He trailed fuse out the door and dropped a coil of it over the stairway railing. Then he went downstairs. 4 sticks on the kitchen counter, beside his bottle of Southern Comfort. 4 sticks in the living room, 4 in the dining room, 4 in the hall. He trailed fuse back into the living room, a little out of breath from going up and downstairs. But there was 1 more trip to make. He went back up and got the crate, which was considerably lighter now. There were only 11 sticks of explosive left inside it. The crate, he saw, had once contained oranges. Written on the side in faded letters was this word, Pomona. Beside the word was a picture of an orange with 1 leaf clinging to the stem. He took the crate out to the garage, using the breezeway this time, and put the box on the back seat of his car. He wired each stick of malglonite with a short fuse, then joined all 11 to a long length with electrician's tape, and strung the long fuse back into the house, being careful to slip the fuse into the crack beneath the side door that opened under the breezeway and then relocking it. In the living room, he joined the housemaster fuse with the one that came from the garage. Working carefully, still humming, he cut another length and joined it to the other 2 with electrician's tape. He paid this final fuse over to the battery and peeled the insulation from the end with the steak knife. He separated the copper core wires and twisted each bunch into a little pigtail. He took the jumper cables and attached the black alligator clip to one pigtail, a red alligator clip to the other. He went to the storage battery and attached the other black alligator clip to the terminal marked pause. He left the red clip unhooked, lying beside the post marked neg. Then he went to the stereo, turned it on, and listened to the Rolling Stones. It was 4:05. He went to the kitchen, made himself another drink, and went back to the living room with it, suddenly at loose ends. There was a copy of Good Housekeeping on the coffee table. There was an article in it about the Kennedy family and their problems. He read the article. After that, he read an article titled Women and Breast Cancer. It was by a woman doctor. They came at 10:05, just after the bells of the Congregational Church 5 blocks over had rung in the hour, calling people to matins, or whatever in hell the Congregationalists called them. There was a green sedan and a black and white police car. They pulled up at the curb and 3 men got out of the green sedan. One of them was Fenner. He didn't know who the other two were. Each of them had a briefcase. 2 policemen got out of the black and white and leaned against it. It was obvious from their attitudes that they expected no trouble. They were discussing something as they leaned against the hood of the black and white, and the words came out of their mouths in visible white puffs. Things stopped. Stop time. January 20, 1974. Well, Fred, this is it. I guess put up or shut up time. Oh, I know in one sense it's too late to shut up. I've got explosives strung all over the house like birthday decorations, a gun in my hand, and another one in my belt like fucking John Dillinger. Well, what do you say? This is the last decision, like climbing a tree. I pick this fork, then I pick that fork, now this, now that. The men frozen in tableau outside in the hallway between seconds, Fenner in a green suit, 1 foot 6 inches off the pavement, as it steps forward, good shoes clad in low fashionable rubbers, if there is such a thing as fashionable rubbers, his green top coat flapping open like a crusading attorney in a TV lead-in. His head is slightly turned, slightly cocked. The man in back of him has made some comment, and Fenner is cocking his head to catch it. The man who has spoken has a white plume half out of his mouth. The second man is wearing a blue blazer and dark brown pants. His top coat is also open, and the wind has caught its stop time, has caught his top coat in mid-flap. The third man is just turning from the car, and the cops are leaning against their black and white with their heads turned to one another. They could be discussing anything, marriage or a tough case or the shitty season the Musties had or the state of their balls, and the sun has come through the scud overhead, just enough to make a single twinkle on a single shell of one policeman's assigned equipment. Said shell pushed through one of many little leather loops on said policeman's belt. The other cop is wearing shades, and the sun has pricked out a compass point on the right lens, and his lips are thick, sensual, caught at the beginning of a smile. This is the photograph. I'm going ahead, Freddy, my boy. Do you have anything you'd care to say at this auspicious moment, at this point in the proceedings? Yes, says Fred. You're going to hold out for the news people, aren't you? I sure am, says George. The words, the pictures, the newsreels, demolition, I know, as only the point of visibility. But, Freddy, does it strike you how lonely this is, how all over the city and the world people are eating and shitting and fucking and scratching their eczema? All the things they write books about while we have to do this alone. Yes, I've considered that, George. In fact, I tried to tell you something about it, if you'll recall. If that's any consolation to you, this seems right. Right now, it seems okay. Because when you can't move, you can give them their road work. But please, George, don't kill anybody. No, not on purpose, Fred. But you see the position I am in. Yes, I see. I understand. By George. I'm scared now. I'm so scared. No, don't be scared. I'm going to handle this, and I'm in perfect control of myself. Roll it.
January 20, 1974. Roll it, he said aloud, and everything began to move. He put the rifle to his shoulder, sighted on the right front wheel of the police cruiser, and pulled the trigger. The gun kicked crushingly against his shoulder, and the muzzle jerked upward after the bullet had been fired. The large living room window burst outward, leaving only jagged hunks protruding from the molding like impressionistic glass arrows. The cruiser's front tire did not flatten. It exploded with a loud bang, and the whole car shuddered on its springs like a dog that had been kicked while asleep. The hubcap flew off and rattled aimlessly on the frozen composition surface of Crestel and Street West. Fenner stopped and looked unbelievingly at the house. His face was raw with shock. The fellow in the blue blazer dropped his briefcase. The other fellow had better reflexes or perhaps a more developed sense of self-preservation. He wheeled and ran around the green sedan, crouched low, and disappeared from sight. The policemen moved right and left behind their own cruiser. A moment later, the one wearing sunglasses bounced up from behind the hood, his service revolver held in both hands, and fired three times. The gun made an innocuous popping sound after the Weatherby's massive crack. He fell behind his chair and heard the bullets pass overhead. You really could hear them, and the noise they made in the air was zzzz, and bury themselves in the plaster above the couch. The sound they made entering the plaster reminded him of the sound fists made hitting the heavy bag in a gymnasium. He thought, that's what they'd sound like going into me. The cop wearing sunglasses was shouting at Fenner and the man in the blue blazer, "Get down! God damn it, get down! He's got a fucking howitzer in there!" He raised his head a little more to see better, and the cop in the sunglasses saw him do it, and fired twice more. The bullets thudded into the wall, and this time Mary's favorite picture, Lobstermen, by Winslow Homer, fell off the wall, hit the couch, and then went to the floor. The glass facing on the picture shattered. He raised his head again because he had to see what was happening. Why hadn't he thought to get a kid's periscope? He had to see if they were trying to flank him, which was how Richard Widmark and Marty Milner always took the Jap pillboxes in the late movies. And if they were trying to do that, he would have to try to shoot one. But the cops were still behind their cruiser, and Fenner and the guy in the blue blazer were dashing behind the green car. Blue Blazer's briefcase lay on the sidewalk like a small, dead animal. He aimed at it, wincing at the recoil of the big rifle even before it came, and fired. Crack! And the briefcase exploded into two pieces and jumped savagely into the air, flapping, disgorging a flutter of papers for the wind to stir an invisible finger through. He fired again, this time at the right front wheel of the green sedan, and the tire blew. One of the men behind the car screamed in soprano terror. He looked over at the police car, and the driver's side door was open. The cop, with the sunglasses, was lying half in on the seat, using his radio. Soon all the partygoers would be here. They were going to give him away. A little piece of anyone who wanted one, and it would not be personal anymore. He felt a relief that was as bitter as aloes. Whatever it had been, whatever mournful sickness that had brought him to this, the last crotch of a tall tree, it was not his alone anymore, whispering and crying in secret. He had joined the mainstream of lunacy. He had come out of the closet. Soon they could reduce him to safe headline, shaky ceasefire holds on Crestellen Street. He put the rifle down and scrambled across the living room floor on his hands and knees, being careful not to cut himself on the glass from the shattered picture frame. He got the small pillow and then scrambled back. The cop was not in the car anymore. He picked up the Magnum and put two shots across their bow. The pistol bucked heavily in his hand, but the recoil was manageable. His shoulder throbbed like a rotted tooth. One of the cops, the one without sunglasses, popped up behind the cruiser's trunk to return his fire, and he sent two bullets into the cruiser's back window, blowing it inward in a twisted craze of cracks. The cop ducked back down without firing.
"Hold it!" Fenner bawled. "Let me talk to him."
"Go ahead," one of the cops said.
"Dawes!"
Fenner yelled toughly, sounding like a detective in the last reel of a Jimmy Cagney movie. The police spotlights are crawling relentlessly back and forth over the front of the sleazy slum tenement where Mad Dog Dawes has gone to ground with a smoking .45 automatic in each hand. Mad Dog is crouched behind an overturned easy chair, wearing a strappy T-shirt and snarling.
"Dawes! Can you hear me in there?"
And Mad Dog, his face twisted with defiance, although his brow is greased with sweat, screams out,
"Come and get me, you dirty coppers!"
He bounced up over the easy chair and emptied the Magnum into the green sedan, leaving a ragged row of holes.
"Jesus!"
somebody screamed.
"Oh, Jesus, he's nuts!"
"Dawes!" Fenner yelled. "You'll never take me alive!" he yelled, delirious with joy. "You're the dirty rats who shot my kid brother! I'll see some of you in hell before you get me!"
He reloaded the Magnum with trembling fingers and then put enough shells into the Weatherby to fill its magazine.
"Dawes!" Finner yelled again. "How about a deal? How about some hot lead, you dirty screw?"
he screamed at Finner, but he was looking at the police car. And when the cop wearing sunglasses put his head stealthily over the hood, he sent him diving with two shots. One of them went through the picture window of the Quinn's home across the street.
"Dawes!"
Fenner yelled importantly. One of the cops said, "Oh, shut the fuck up! You're just encouraging him!" There was an embarrassed silence, and in it the sound of sirens, still distant, began to rise. He put the Magnum down and picked up the rifle. The joyous delirium had left him feeling tired and achy and needing to shit. "Please let them be quick from the TV stations," he prayed. "Quick with their movie cameras." When the first police car screamed around the corner in a calculated racing drift like something out of the French Connection, he was ready. He had fired two of the howitzer shells over the parked cruiser to make them stay down, and he drew a careful bead on the grill of the charging cruiser and squeezed the trigger like a seasoned Richard Widmark-type veteran, and the whole grill seemed to explode, and the hood flew up. The cruiser roared straight over the curb about 40 yards up the street and hit a tree. The doors flew open, and four cops spilled out with their guns drawn, looking dazed. Two of them walked into each other. Then the cops behind the first cruiser, his cops, he thought of them with a trace of propriety, opened fire, and he submarined behind the chair while the bullets whizzed above him. It was 11:17. He thought that now they would try to flank him. He stuck his head up, because he had to, and a bullet droned past his right ear. Two more cruisers were coming up Crest Allen Street from the other direction, sirens whooping, blue lights flashing. Two of the cops from the crashed cruiser were trying to climb the stake fence between the sidewalk and the upslinger's backyard, and he fired the rifle at them three times, not firing to hit or miss, but only to make them go back to their car. They did. Wood from Wilbur Upslinger's fence, ivy climbed on it in the spring and summer, sprayed everywhere, and part of it actually fell over into the snow. The two new cruisers had pulled up in a V that blocked the road in front of Jack Hobart's house. Police crouched in the apex of the V. One of them was talking to the police in the crash cruiser on a walkie-talkie. A moment later, the newest arrivals began laying down a heavy pattern of covering fire, making him duck again. Bullets struck the front door, the front of the house, and all around the picture window. The mirror in the front hall exploded into jumbled diamonds. A bullet punched through the quilt covering the Zenith TV, and the quilt danced briefly. He scrambled across the living room on his hands and knees and stood up by the small window behind the TV. From here, he could look directly into the upslinger's backyard. Two policemen were trying the flanking movement again. One of them had a nosebleed. "Freddie, I may have to kill one of them to make them stop."
"Don't do that, George. Please, don't do that."
He smashed the window with the butt of the Magnum, cutting his hand. They looked around at the noise, saw him, and began to shoot. He returned their fire and saw two of his bullets punch holes in Wilbur's new aluminum siding. Had the city recompensed him for that? He heard bullets punching into his own house just below the window and on both sides of it. One whined off the frame, and splinters flew in his face. He expected a bullet to rip off the top of his head at any moment. It was hard to tell how long the exchange went on. Suddenly, one of the cops grabbed his forearm and cried out. The cop dropped his pistol like a child that has grown tired of a stupid game. He ran in a small circle. His partner grabbed him, and they began to run back toward their crashed cruiser, the unhurt one with his arm around his partner's waist. He dropped to his hands and knees and crawled back to the overturned chair and peeked out. Two more cruisers on the street now, one coming from each end. They parked on the Quinn's side of the street, and eight policemen got out and ran behind the cruiser with the flat tire and the green sedan. He put his head down again and crawled into the hall. The house was taking very heavy fire now. He knew he should take the rifle and go upstairs. He would have a better angle on them from up there. Could maybe drive them back from their car to cover in the houses across the street. But he didn't dare go that far from the master fuse and the storage battery. The TV people might come at any time. The front door was full of bullet holes, the dark brown varnish splintered back to show the raw wood underneath. He crawled into the kitchen,
All the windows were broken in here, and broken glass littered the linoleum. A chance shot had knocked the coffee pot from the stove, and it lay overturned in a puddle of brown goo. He crouched below the window for a moment, then bounced up and emptied the Magnum into the V-parked cars. Immediately, fire intensified on the kitchen. Two bullet holes appeared in the white enamel of the refrigerator, and another struck the Southern Comfort bottle on the counter. It exploded, spraying glass and Southern hospitality everywhere. Crawling back to the living room, he felt something like a bee sting in the fleshy part of his right thigh, just below the buttocks, and when he clapped his hand to it, his fingers came away bloody. He lay behind the chair and reloaded the Magnum, reloaded the Weatherby, poked his head up and ducked back down, wincing at the ferocity of fire that came at him, bullets striking the couch and the wall and the TV, making the quilt shimmy. Poked his head up again and fired at the police cars parked across the street. Blew in one window, and saw, at the top of the street, a white station wagon and a white Ford van. Written in blue letters on the sides of both was WHLM Newsbeat, Channel 9. Panting, he crawled back to the window that looked out on the upslinger's side yard. The news vehicles were crawling slowly and dubiously down Crestallen Street. Suddenly a new police car shot around them and blocked them off, tires smoking. An arm dressed in blue shot out of the cruiser's back window and began waving the newsmobiles off. A bullet struck the windowsill and jumped into the room at an angle. He crawled back to the easy chair, holding the Magnum in his bloody right hand, and screamed, "Finner!" The fire slackened a little. "Finner!" he screamed again.
"Hold on!" Finner yelled. "Stop! Stop a minute!"
There were a few isolated pops, then nothing.
"What do you want?" Finner called.
"The news people. Down behind those cars on the other side of the street. I want to talk to them."
There was a long, contemplative pause.
"No!"
Finner yelled.
"I'll stop shooting if I can talk to them."
That much was true, he thought, looking at the battery.
"No!"
Finner yelled again. "Bastard," he thought helplessly. "Is it that important to you? You and Ordner and the rest of you bureaucratic bastards?" The firing began again, tentatively at first, then gaining strength. Then, incredibly, a man in a plaid shirt and blue jeans was running down the sidewalk, holding a pistol-grip camera in one hand.
"I heard that," the man in the plaid shirt yelled. "I heard every word. I'll get your name, fella. He offered to stop shooting, and you—"
A policeman hit him with a waist-high flying tackle, and the man in the plaid shirt crunched to the sidewalk. His movie camera flew into the gutter, and a moment later three bullets shattered it into winking pieces. A clock spring of unexposed film unwound lazily from the remains. Then the fire flagged again, uncertainly.
"Finner! Let them set up!" he hollered.
His throat felt raw and badly used, like the rest of him. His hand hurt, and a deep throbbing ache had begun to emanate outward from his thigh.
"Come out first," Finner yelled back. "We'll let you tell your side of it."
Rage washed over him in a red wave at this bare-faced lie.
"God damn it! I've got a big gun here, and I'll start shooting at gas tanks, you shitbird, and there'll be a fucking barbecue when I get done!"
Shocked silence. Then, cautiously, Finner said,
"What do you want?"
"Send that guy you tackled in here. Let the camera crew set up."
"Absolutely not. We're not giving you a hostage to play games with all day."
A cop ran over to the listing green sedan, bent low, and disappeared behind it. There was a consultation. A new voice yelled,
"There's 30 men behind your house, guy. They've got shotguns. Come out, or I'll send them in."
Time to play his one ratty trump.
"You better not. The whole house is wired with explosive. Look at this."
He held the red alligator clip up in the window.
"Can you see it?"
"You're bluffing,"
the voice called back confidently.
"If I hook this up to the car battery beside me on the floor, everything goes."
Silence. More consultation.
Hey! Someone yelled. Hey, get that guy!
He poked his head up to look, and here came the man in the plaid shirt and jeans, right out into the street, no protection, either heroically sure of his own profession or crazy. He had long black hair that fell almost to his collar and a thin, dark mustache. Two cops started to charge around the V-parked cruisers and thought better of it when he put a shot over their heads.
Jesus Christ, what a snafu!
Somebody cried out in shrill disgust. The man in the plaid shirt was on his lawn now, kicking up snowbursts. Something buzzed by his ear, followed by a report, and he realized he was still looking over the chair. He heard the front door being tried, and then the man in the plaid shirt was hammering on it. He scrambled across the floor, which was now spotted with grit and plaster that had been knocked out of the walls. His right leg hurt like a bastard, and when he looked down, he saw his pants leg was bloody from thigh to knee. He turned the lock in the chewed-up door and released the bolt from its catch.
"Okay,"
he said, and the man in the plaid shirt burst in. Up close, he didn't look scared, although he was panting hard. There was a scrape on his cheek from where the policeman had tackled him, and the left arm of his shirt was ripped. When the man in the plaid shirt was inside, he scrambled back into the living room, picked up the rifle, and fired twice blindly over the top of the chair. Then he turned around. The man in the plaid shirt was standing in the doorway, looking incredibly calm. He had taken a large notebook out of his back pocket.
"All right, man," he said. "What shit goes down?"
"What's your name?"
"Dave Albert."
"Has that white van got more film equipment in it?"
"Yes."
"Go to the window. Tell the police to let a camera crew set up on the Quinn's lawn. That's the house across the street. Tell them if it isn't done in 5 minutes, you got trouble."
"Do I?"
"Sure." Albert laughed.
"You don't look like you could kill time, fella."
"Tell them." Albert walked to the shattered living room window and stood framed there for a second, obviously relishing the moment.
"He says for my camera crew to set up across the street," he yelled. "He says he's going to kill me if you don't let them."
"No!"
Finner yelled back furiously.
"No, no,
Somebody muzzled him. Silence for a beat.
"All right."
This was the voice that had accused them of bluffing about the explosive.
"Will you let two of our men go up and get them?"
He thought it over and nodded at the reporter.
"Yes,"
Albert called. There was a pause, and then two uniformed policemen trotted self-consciously up toward where the news van waited, its engine smugly idling. In the meantime, two more cruisers had pulled up, and by leaning far to the right, he could see that the downhill end of Crest Allen Street West had been blocked off. A large crowd of people was standing behind the yellow crash barriers.
"Okay," Albert said, sitting down. "We got a minute. What do you want? A plane?"
"Plane?" he echoed stupidly. Albert flapped his arms, still holding his notebook.
"Fly away, man. Just fly away."
"Oh." He nodded to show that he understood. "No, I don't want a plane."
"Then what do you want?"
"I want," he said carefully, "to be just 20, with a lot of decisions to make over again." He saw the look in Albert's eyes and said, "I know I can't. I'm not that crazy."
"You're shot."
"Yes."
"Is that what you said it is?"
He was pointing at the master fuse and the battery.
"Yes. The main fuse goes to all the rooms in the house, also the garage."
"Where did you get the explosive?"
Albert's voice was amiable, but his eyes were alert.
"Found it in my Christmas stocking."
He laughed.
"Say, that's not bad. I'm going to use that in my story."
"Fine. When you go back out, tell all the policemen that they better move away."
"Are you going to blow yourself up?"
Albert asked. He looked interested, nothing more.
"I am contemplating it."
"You know what, fellow? You've seen too many movies."
"I don't go to the movies much anymore. I did see The Exorcist, though. I wish I hadn't. How are your movie guys coming out there?"
Albert peered out the window.
"Pretty good. We've got another minute. Your name is Dawes?"
"Did they tell you that?"
Albert laughed contemptuously.
"They wouldn't tell me if I had cancer. I read it on the doorbell. Would you mind telling me why you're doing all this?"
Not at all. It's road work.
The extension?
Albert's eyes glowed brighter. He began to scribble in his book.
Yes, that's right.
They took your house?
They tried. I'm going to take it.
Albert wrote it down, then snapped his book closed and stuffed it into his back pocket again. That's pretty stupid, Mr. Dawes. Do you mind my saying that? Why don't you just come out of here with me?
You've got an exclusive, he said tiredly. What are you trying for, the Pulitzer Prize?
I'd take it if they offered it.
He smiled brightly and then sobered.
Come on, Mr. Dawes. Come on out. I'll see that your side gets told. I'll see.
There is no side. Albert frowned.
What was that?
I have no side. That's why I'm doing this.
He peered over the chair and looked into a telephoto lens, mounted on a tripod that was sunk into the snow of the Quinn's lawn.
Go on now. Tell them to go away.
Are you really going to pull the string?
I really don't know.
Albert walked to the living room door and then turned around. Do I know you from somewhere? Why do I keep feeling like I know you? He shook his head. He thought he had never seen Albert before in his life. Watching the newsman walk back across his lawn, slightly at an angle so the camera across the street would get his good side, he wondered what Olivia was doing at that precise second. He waited 15 minutes. Their fire had intensified, but no one charged at the back of the house. The main purpose of the fire seemed to be to cover their retreat into the houses across the street. The camera crew remained where it was for a while, grinding impassively away, and then the white Econoline van drove up onto the Quinn's side lawn, and the man behind the camera folded the tripod, took it behind the truck, and began to film again. Something black and tubular whizzed through the air, landed on his lawn about midway between the house and the sidewalk, and began to spurt gas. The wind caught it and carried it off down the street in tattered rifts. A second shell landed short, and then he heard one clunk on the roof. He caught a whiff of that one as it fell into the snow covering Mary's begonias. His nose and eyes filled with crocodile tears. He scurried across the living room on his hands and knees again, hoping to God he had said nothing to that newsman, Albert, that could be misconstrued as profound. There was no good place to make your stand in the world. Look at Johnny Walker, dying in a meaningless intersection smash-up. What had he died for? So that the sheets could go through? Or that woman in the supermarket? The fucking you got was never worth the screwing you took. He turned on the stereo, and the stereo still worked. The Rolling Stones album was still on the turntable, and he put on the last cut, missing the right groove the first time when a bullet smacked into the quilt covering the Zenith TV with a thud. When he had it right, the last bars of Monkey Man fading into nothingness, he scurried back to the overturned chair and threw the rifle out the window. He picked up the Magnum and threw that out after it. Goodbye, Nick Adams. A tear gas canister arched through the window, struck the wall over the couch, and exploded in white smoke. He grasped the red alligator clip in his hand.
Okay, he muttered,
and jammed the red clip on the negative pole of the battery. He closed his eyes, and his last thought was that the world was not exploding around him, but inside him. And while the explosion was cataclysmic, it was not larger than, say, a good-sized walnut. Then white. Epilogue. The WHLM news team won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of what they called Dawes' Last Stand on the evening news and for a half-hour documentary presented 3 weeks later. The documentary was called Road Work, and it examined the necessity, or lack of it, for the 784 extension. The documentary pointed out that one reason the road was being built had nothing to do with traffic patterns or commuter convenience or anything else of such a practical sort. The municipality had to build so many miles of road per year or begin losing federal money on all interstate construction. And so the city had chosen to build. The documentary also pointed out that the city was quietly beginning a litigation against the widow of Barton George Dawes to recover as much of their money as was recoverable. In the wake of the outcry, the city dropped its suit. Still photographs of the wreckage ran on the AP wire, and most of the newspapers in the country carried them. In Las Vegas, a young girl who had only recently enrolled in a business school saw the photographs while on her lunch hour and fainted. Despite the pictures and the words, the extension went ahead and was completed 18 months later, ahead of schedule. By that time, most of the people in the city had forgotten the roadwork documentary, and the city's news force, including Pulitzer winner David Albert, had gone on to other stories and crusades. But few people who had been watching the original news clip broadcast on the evening news ever forgot that. They remembered even after the facts surrounding it grew blurry in their minds. That news clip showed a plain white suburban house, sort of a ranch house with an asphalt driveway to the right leading to a one-car garage. A nice-looking house, but totally ordinary. Not a house you'd crane to look at if you happened to be on a Sunday drive. But in the news footage, the picture window is shattered. Two guns, a rifle and a pistol, come flying out of it to lie in the snow. For 1 second you see the hand that has flung them, the fingers held limply up like the hand of a drowning man. You see white smoke blowing around the house, mace or tear gas or something. And then there is a huge belch of orange flame, and all the walls of the house seem to bulge out in an impossible cartoon convexity. And there is a huge detonation, and the camera shakes a little as if in horror. Peripherally, the viewer is aware that the garage has been destroyed in a single ripping blast. For a second, it seems, and slow-motion replays prove that the eye's split-second impression is correct, that the roof of the house has lifted off its eaves like a Saturn rocket. Then the entire house blows outward and upward, shingles flying, hunks of wood lofted into the air and then returning to earth. Something that looks like a quilt twisting lazily in the air like a magic carpet as debris rattled to the ground in a thudding contrapuntal drum roll. There is stillness. Then the shocked, tear-streaming face of Mary Dawes fills the screen. She is looking with drugged and horrified bewilderment at the forest of microphones being thrust into her face. And we have been brought safely back to human things once more.
Roadwork was written by Stephen King, writing as Richard Bachman, and read by G. Valmont Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.